Good afternoon.
I believe in starting reviews right on the dot. I've been asked to record this thing, and I usually have a pocket for the recorder, so I'm just going to have to hold it, I guess. And I hope the sound comes through. All right, again, tomorrow is the exam, as it's been in the class. You need a number 2 pencil, an orange Scantron, and your R number, and really nothing else, as it were. There were 4 topics in this segment, and what I thought I would do today is what I did the last time, is put the outline up on the board and invite, first of all, any questions on each segment of the lecture. If you have a gap in your notes, or if there's something that you wrote down that you aren't sure about or can't remember, would like clarified, this would be the time to ask, and we'll go from there. So, fair enough. Are there any just general questions about logistics or details? Anything like that before we get into the content? Yeah. Well, we're getting into the content. I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, I just want to know if there's any questions about details. You're absolutely sure about the mechanics of the exam and all that. Go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move to that then. The individual in society is where we started, socialization. And I think I talked about socialization, the technical definition, just being housebroken. Become civil social creatures. Are there any questions about the 2.5 new dead white guys? 2 new ones and 1 we nodded about before. Meade, Cooley, let's put them in the right order. Cooley, Meade, and Goffman. Any questions about any of that? About Charles Horton Cooley and the Looking Glass Self. Questions? We sort of see ourselves reflected in others' eyes, and our identity is shaped by how others react to us, essentially. Meade had 3 stages of development. He called it the emerging self, the imitative play and game stage. Questions? We begin to grow and grow beyond being totally self-absorbed and understand that others have a place and have rules that we have to adhere to. The rules of the game go beyond simply imitating and then being at the center of attention. Okay, the next segment, these really aren't terms to be defined. Does anybody have a question about anything I said, first of all? Yeah. Oh, clarify Goffman's work in this section as opposed to others. I think what where I distinguished Goffman here was that he, you know, we talked about life as drama and all that, and Goffman talked about front stage and front region and all that. But I thought what was useful here is to see where Goffman was coming from. Goffman's main deal is impression management. And you can see, I hope, that that builds on where Cooley was coming from many years prior. You know, that we're really reacting and adjusting based on how other people react to us. Well, Goffman sort of turns that around and said we can stack the deck and sort of manage how others react to us in some way. So he's taking what Cooley has argued is the case and given us a little control. So I think the point here, at least in that lecture, was linking Goffman to his sort of ideological forebears, as it were. Because he's certainly 20th century, and the others are before that. Questions on what I talked about with regard to childhood, adolescence, and adulthood? Any gaps in the notes there that you'd like me to clarify?
Got one for
sure.
For adulthood.
For what?
Adulthood.
All right.
Will you define
that? Well, these aren't really terms to be defined. I think what I said, and if I haven't, I wish I had, that these are really predictable phases that have benchmarks that are pretty common to everybody. That the life cycle of human beings is fairly common and predictable. That childhood are the years up until puberty, sort of. And then we've got this intermediate phase where we can do some things as an adult, but we are still children at heart, and maybe we never outgrow that. And then there's this move into early adulthood where we kind of get our lives cranked up a little bit. And suddenly we're hit at midlife, and we're back at 14 again. We're in this sort of, you know, intermediate stage again. And then as aging process kicks in, we start to realize that we have lived way more years than we're going to, and then we start sort of living our lives as though we understood them to be more vital and precious even. You know, that there are these sort of predictable emotional phases we go through, and typically we learn the same things each step along the way. So I was basically saying here is that any one life is similar in its benchmarks to all life, in a sense. And this is Daniel Levinson's model, although that's less important than sort of getting the idea. Okay, anything so far on anything I've got on the screen? Agents of socialization. We talked about who does the housebreaking, as it were. And we'll have to scroll down a little bit. Family being the focus of it. Questions on family, school, peer group? Yeah. Sure. How does the school go with it? I think the major takeaway there was that schools, public education particularly, tends to reinforce where we start with the family. And in the family, we get gender role socialization and habit training, essentially. But gender role socialization is reinforced by the schools. I think that schools tend to So they sort of lock that in. You know, we grow up in a pink and blue world, and the school sort of is our first entree into the world beyond our house, where that's still true, basically.
Do we have to know about the, like with family, do we have to know about the whole certain parents are more about following the rules and other parents are about negotiating the rules?
I love questions like that. Do we have to know? You don't have to know anything. Or you have to know. What you have to know is what helps you. I think you meant is that stuff about social class and parenting skills going to be on the test? That was really the question, right? Yeah, sneaky way of asking it. I don't know. I don't remember what's on the test. But what I said, if you'd like to review that, is that there's a social class bias with regard to how parents tend to raise their kids. That working class parents tend more to value in their own parenting and in their kids' outcomes, play by the rules and work hard. And I don't think middle and upper class parents would say that's wrong, but they would be more inclined to say it's okay to question the rules, and maybe that's useful. And there's an education component to that. Okay? Yeah.
It's less appropriate in society for them to be assertive with boys. Is there another example you could give?
Yeah, I can talk about that for a minute. What she's asking is, or she's referring back to basically how I illustrated the point you just asked about. What's up with schools? They tend to reinforce what we learn in the family. And what I remember talking about is pointing out, and research has shown this, that school-age girls are rebuked, if not overtly punished, for doing the same thing that boys do when the boys get reward for being assertive. Boys are rewarded for being assertive, and girls are punished for being aggressive when the behavior is the same. It's all part of sugar and spice and everything nice, and get after it. You know, there's a difference there. Boys are socialized generally to be more competitive. Girls are socialized generally to be more cooperative. And that's just another, I mean, any way you can think of to illustrate that, there's a distinction that's generally the case, you know, competitive and aggressive versus cooperative and compliant. And again, those are endpoints on a continuum. I want to make sure you understand that. But the school process, the public education process, tends to reinforce that, and that's the point. Okay? School, family, peer group, media, yeah.
Peer group?
I think I defined it a couple of different ways, but this is where I think it's a good place to hang this notion of anticipatory socialization. That is, we sort of rehearse for real life when we're sort of protected. We tend to try out new behavior, like driving and drinking, among other things, with our peers before we move forward. But it's also true that, for example, living in a dorm is like living in your own house, but it isn't your own house, and there are more rules and so on. We sort of ease into full responsibility, and peer group is kind of where we test this stuff out. Peer influence tends to supersede parental influence at some point, and you know, it varies from person to person and situation to situation, but we tend to rely more on our peers in later adolescence than our parents, and that's sort of the reverse of early adolescence. What else on family, school, peer group, media, workplace? Media? I think I talked about the argument, or the debate, I should say, whether media determines behavior or reflects it. And the answer is both. I think, however, the research suggests it's more reflective than determinative, and when it determines our behavior, that's usually because we're processing what we see or experience in watching a movie or playing a video game or on social media. The influence of media is mediated, I think, through our interactions and relationships. Otherwise, I think media largely reflects what's out there and in some ways has to play catch up, as it were. Is that what I said? Okay, just making sure. Workplace is it's another source of being able to say, this is who I am. I am an architect. I am a physician. I am a fry cook, or whatever it is. We hook our identity toward what we do at work. Any questions on any of that before we move into the last one? Church, good with that? Yeah, I think, I don't know, I don't remember exactly where I went with this in lecture. I go all over the place sometimes, and sometimes it's different from year to year. But what I would say, what I think the key learning on this is that religious entities tend also to reflect things like gender roles and all of that. They tend to focus more on moral behavior. And to the extent that influences other institutions like education, well, that's sort of contested. You know, you will find that religion will work its way into school board discussions about textbooks, and that's going to vary by region, you know, especially in terms of the kind of textbooks there are. I think the larger takeaway is that there's this sort of assumption that religion is good for us, even if we're not religious, that it creates a sort of, and Durkheim talked about this, kind of a moral fabric, as it were. And I think I pointed out, and we'll get to it again, I pointed out that as a collectivity, as a culture, we pay churches to do this through tax breaks. Now, we pay all nonprofits to do this too. And Texas Tech is also a nonprofit gaining from tax benefits in that regard. What else on anything related to this lecture? Anything at all? Going all the way back up again to Cooley, Mead, Goffman, Life Cycle, Agents of Socialization. Going once, gone. All right, we flipped around a little bit, and the next piece we went to was social deviance. And the logic of that was we talk about how we learn and play by the rules. Let's talk about the consequences and causes of breaking the rules. Basic definition is deviance is a description rather than a judgment. And we have rewards and punishments that are formal and informal for keeping and breaking rules. Any questions on those first couple of things?
Informal social control
is the kind of regulation that occurs in families and friendship groups. You know when you step in it with somebody you care about or that cares about you, right? They'll let you know, they'll take you aside, they'll give you a look, they'll send you a text or something, you know.
Right.
Different from making you pay them money or having to, or you know, something formal like that, a fine, a jail sentence, a grade on a test. Those are more formal social controls. And honestly, most of our life is governed by informal social control. Which is not to say that, you know, our class has formal control mechanisms built in it too, and it's not just government. I mean, it's everywhere. There are formalities that go even with religion. You know, you have to, you know, demonstrate a certain level of loyalty and faith to maybe be confirmed or married in the church or whatever. You know, there are formal controls everywhere, and informal more with regard to family and so on. Okay, what else? What else on that? Yeah. Would I say what?
Would informal and formal both be on the macro level, or would informal be more of a macro and informal be?
That's an interesting question. She asked whether these you could distinguish macro and micro by looking at formal and informal social controls. I kind of say both. I think that informal social control tends to be more visible on the micro level. You know, where someone will rebuke you with a voice, or give you a big smile, or a hug, or something like that. But I mean, there are social norms that everybody understands. You know, like standing or kneeling or sitting for the national anthem. I guess, well, there is a, you know, that's contested. But you get, so there is a macro component to informal, but also that tends to happen more on the micro level. Formal social controls tend to be instituted through institutions, and I'm recording this crap. Can you believe that? Getting fined for speeding, getting put in jail for stealing something, that kind of thing. They tend to derive from a macro level and play out personally. I think informal social control tends to derive from an interaction and then sort of become custom after that. I just made that up. So if you thought that was great, write that thing down. That's just a way of explaining. That was a good question. And I think it's important that we try to resist pigeonholing everything. I mean, even functionalism and conflict theory, which tend to be easily defined, at least so far, there is a continuum there. You know, and it's also true that this, you know, formal, macro, micro is kind of a continuum more than boxes, let's put it that way. Or at least there are bridges between the boxes. Why is there deviance? Deviance is useful. Questions on that? Yeah. Sure. How is it useful? Good question. Well, the argument here is that, first of all, from a functionalist point of view, nothing persists in a society unless it has some purpose. If it becomes useless, it disappears. It's sort of evolutionary, survival of the fittest. Well, we have, you know, deviant behavior, horrifically so. And three things happen as a result. Social unity. I mean, even this horror in Las Vegas the other day has drawn us together in some ways. Now, there have been some points of discussion and division about that, too, with regard to gun control and all that. But we tend to be drawn together when under pressure, when under attack, if you will. It also helps us clarify what's in and out of bounds. It clarifies the boundaries a little bit, you know. And these shift over time, but by consensus. What is appropriate in the context of a television show? Well, it kind of depends. If you're in the 50s and anything is remotely suggestive, probably is out the window. But as we move into the 70s and 80s and technology starts to take over, we have HBO and other pay cable services, and as long as it's on HBO and you don't have to just stumble into it without paying for it, it's probably okay. You know, George Carlin shows up on HBO with a, you know, brutally vulgar and satiric comedy, which is arguably thought-provoking and useful, but it's only on HBO for a while. So we sort of negotiate what those boundaries are. And ultimately, it creates a level of social change, as it were. It took peaceful resistance to Jim Crow laws to get the buses in the schools and the lunch counters and the hotels desegregated. So social change comes about, in some sense, by breaking rules that really need to go, as it were. What else on that? That's a real counterintuitive idea, you know, that deviance is useful. But it does carry with it what, in the long run, turn out to be beneficial social realities. Deviance is inevitable from a conflict point of view. Questions?
Can you just, like, give examples?
Yeah, I think the soundbite on that was the rich get richer and the poor get prison. Why play by the rules if the rules don't help? If there are no jobs where you live, you sell illegal drugs to earn money because everybody needs to pay rent, right? As it were. went through a whole long thing on the process of how discretion through the criminal justice system creates inequality, that the prison population looks vastly different than the general population with regard to demographics. You had a question? Jeffrey Ryman wrote the book, The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Prisoned.
So essentially, is that just meaning that prisons are, they do not reflect the
What he's arguing is that the prison population is the result of a great deal of inequality in the criminal justice system. That there's 6 or 7 stages from going from being under suspicion to being in prison, and at every step there's a level of discretion and a benefit accorded to some and not others that may have nothing to do with guilt or innocence, but it may have everything to do with how many resources they have. That's his argument. And the prison population we know looks very different than the general population. He's saying that's why. That these are mostly people with fewer resources going in, and they're more likely to wind up in prison. I think there were 2 people that were actually convicted of a crime in the Enron debacle, and neither of them went to prison, I don't think. So that sort of thing. And then that organized criminal process was just beyond describable in its complexity and its effect. Deviance is useful, deviance is inevitable. Any other questions on that? Okay, now we have a laundry list of terms and definitions. Index crimes, professional crimes, organized crimes, and so on. Any questions about what that's about and how it's redefined? Professional crime is a way of earning a living by doing something illegal. It's a way of earning a living by doing something illegal. Okay? Yeah. The difference between professional and organized crime, kind of a level of analysis. Professional criminals tend to work for organized criminal enterprises. Organized crime is kind of a bureaucracy for illegal things. Drug cartels are a good example. Or the pharmaceutical industry, I guess. That's white collar crime, yeah. See, I knew you'd catch me, that was good. Organized crime is a bureaucracy for illegal activity, and professional criminals tend to get jobs in organized criminal enterprises. So it's sort of a level of analysis. And since you mentioned it, white-collar crime are crimes committed by people that you wouldn't think would be criminals, like people who make a lot of money doing other things that aren't illegal, and then take that legal enterprise and criminalize it by lying, essentially, or defrauding, or in some way misrepresenting usually the safety of their product, and people wind up getting blown up in cars or dying of risks that they did not know or were warned about with regard to taking medications and so on. Or they have their bank accounts or identities compromised or drained through criminal activity. Victimless crime, gambling, prostitution, illegal drug use, it's an arguable point in that I think most families would say we're victims too. But that's really the deal. We talked about the war on drugs briefly, that we are now rethinking how we're fighting the war on illegal drugs, and that we have now legalized marijuana in a variety of places, 5 or 6 states, largely to derive some tax benefit. I mean, the value of the marijuana crop in the U.S. is equal to most other agricultural products, which is a massive amount of money that winds up in the legitimate enterprise, and then or the legitimate economy, I should say, and is not taxed. So that's we're shifting how we have decided what to fight in fighting the war on drugs. And we've taken marijuana out of the equation in the same way as, in a different way than we still have things like heroin and cocaine. Is that all I had on that? What else did I do? Is that it? Yeah. Oh, index crimes were 8 specific crimes, sure. Index crimes are the ones that the government keeps track of and publishes in the Uniform Crime Reports. There are 4 crimes against people, homicide, assault, sexual assault, and robbery, and four crimes against property, burglary, theft, auto theft, and arson. And those are not the ones that we tend to be most vulnerable to. They're the ones that scare us. They involve guns and other things. But we're far more likely to be victimized by white-collar crime than by index crime. And I suppose, you know, we're starting to split hairs here, that if you're defrauded and your bank account is drained, well, certainly that's an index crime that's called theft. But unknowingly using a dangerous product is a crime. It's not one of the index crimes, and it's one, fraud without gaining, you know, monetary value and so on. We're far more likely to have our identity stolen than our car. Yeah? Difference between robbery, burglary, and theft. Sort of the level of personal contact. Theft means you left it here and I took it. Right, I stole something that was just laying there. Robbery means I sort of went into your house and stole it. That's burglary, I mean. Robbery is taking it from you. Right? Taking it from an open place is theft. Taking it from a building is burglary. Taking it from you personally is robbery. That personal encounter makes it a crime against a person. Sort of how close am I to a human being is the distinction. What else on deviance at all? Anything else on that second piece? Okay, I think the next thing we did was social structure and interaction, right? Is that what we did? Okay, and I think structure is the framework within which we interact, these social structural realities. These elements of social structure create a kind of frame that almost become kind of boundaries for where and how we interact. So that's what I meant by social structure. And then interaction is kind of the more or less predictable ways that we encounter and deal with one another. Until we screw around with it, with ethnomethodology. We'll get to that in a minute. All right. Social status, social roles, ascribed, achieved, master status, role ambiguity, role strain, role conflict. What's unclear to any of you at this point? Yeah. Master status. That's kind of like the one thing that characterizes you. It's the one thing through which everything else is seen. If you are a Nobel Prize winner, and they're announcing the Nobel Prizes this week, or if you're an Olympic gold medalist or an Academy Award winner, or perhaps just being young, being old, being Anglo, being non-Anglo, being hetero, being non-hetero, any of these things can kind of be almost the prefix of your first name. You know, oh, there's the preacher. Oh, wait a minute, what's his name? I forgot, but he's the preacher, right? It's kind of the one thing that defines us as a master. And these are all job titles, by the way. Things that we can achieve, things that we sort of land with at birth, like age, sex, ethnicity, race. These are ascribed statuses. We achieve college graduate, drunk driver, that kind of thing. You had a question. Yeah, role conflict is our incompatible expectations. The example I think I used in class was being someone's best friend who just violated an honor code in the military. Those are conflicting expectations. So every job title, every identity, every label you hang on yourself is a status position, and each of those have expectations that go with them. These expectations can conflict. Dearest, best, lifelong friend and violator of honor code, conflict. Go ahead.
What's the difference between master and social status?
What's the difference between master and social status? Master status is one form of a social status. Social status generally are just, these are just the lists of identities that we hold. And a master status might be one of those. I mean, you are male, you have an age, you are of an ethnicity, you are of a religion, all those titles that you have. There might be one that sort of supersedes it all, right? And for me, often as not, or in some contexts, being a preacher is what becomes the sort of prefix for my first name. Roll ambiguity or unclear expectations. Roll strain or too many expectations. Any questions on roles and statuses? Groups, we did, we talked a lot about them in the next segment, but they're just a number of people that have similar sets of rules, similar sets of interests, similar sets of values, and they get together now and then for a variety of reasons. Friendship, networking, goal attainment, that kind of thing. Questions on that? Functionalist conflict and ethnomethodology? View of groups? Sure. From a functionalist point of view, groups represent connections to institutions. We have my family and the family, right? We have my college and education, my work group in the economy, my church and religion, as it were. These social institutions work together to create a kind of functionality, but a lot of that functionality is mediated through groups. Does that sound anything like what I said in lecture? Okay, because I don't remember. Social groups that reflect these institutions. Remember what the institutions are: family, religion, education, government, healthcare, economy. There are social groups underneath all of those. And what is it that I said? Because it sounded really good.
Great obligations.
I must have come up with that on the fly I'm going to have to write that down. That'll go in the next lecture set of notes. Social groups create opportunities and obligations. Wow. No, that's true. I mean, we join a group, we've got an opportunity to learn something or advance in some way, but we are obliged to hold up our end. And these obligations and opportunities connect us to the larger world. Social groups and our membership in them, I guess, can kind of be a self and society bridge. Let's put it that way. So that's how they function, right? From a conflict point of view, all this functionality reproduces inequality. Okay. That what it mainly does is it keeps resources where they already are. And so nothing really changes. The rich get richer and the poor get prison.
Is that basically saying that, like, the point of view is that social institutions produce, like, a positive reality?
Yeah, they produce social stability. Okay. And the argument from a conflict point of view is that they produce social inequality.
Okay, so it's just...
Yeah, that was simple. I should have come up with that in lecture. That social groups are sources of stability and create functionality. And, I mean, there's hardly a semester that goes by that somewhere on some college campus, some social group is accused of discriminatory behavior. Nobody sees this sign that says whites only on a campus group or something, but everybody knows that's what it means. Right? Yeah, I think ethnomethodology is the interactionist view of social institutions. In other words, they're completely artificial. We have invented them, right? And we can screw with them in our heads. And I talked about doing things like imagining or even behaving at home in a way that you walk down and you treat your parents as though they were strangers or you were guests in a stranger's home or something like that. Or you exhaustively clarify what's meant or what's seen or what's understood. The counseling experiment that I talked about is an elegant example of how perception is reality. And it even gives us a perception of the entire mental health industry. And it can be completely artificial, completely made up, completely random. The argument here is that our social world is infinitely complex and entirely subjective. Now, that's an extreme point of view and arguable. But that's the interactionist view of social institutions. Okay? So at what level is ethnomethodology operating on, macro or micro? Very much on a micro level. What else then on social structure and social interaction before we get to the last piece? Anything else on...
Can you define
Ethnomethodology would be defined as a research protocol, folk methods, studying people in the act of being themselves. Okay. The word ethnomethodology means folk methods. It's a style of research that just looks at people being who they are and then, you know, messes with reality a little bit, changes our view, or intentionally breaches or breaks rules to gauge how deeply held they are. The elevator thing that I went through, or the negotiating the price of a drink at McDonald's or something like that. Anything else on that? Number four. Oh, this is a useful little handout, by the way, that distinguishes status and roles. You want to just have a look at that. Ethnomethodology, just examples of it. Groups and organizations. All right. Primary, secondary groups. We clear on the definitions and distinctions. If not, one page down is a whole handout, primary and secondary groups. Primary groups are the ones that matter to us emotionally. Secondary groups tend to matter to us materially. Questions on that? What's the most accessible secondary group in your world right now? College what? Yeah, the class. What's the most accessible primary group in your world right now? Mom, dad, junior, and sis. In-groups and out-groups illustrate ethnomethodology in a way because we keep them in our heads. Groups to which we are drawn, groups to against which we are repelled. You know what they are. Think back to high school. Reference groups, your Thanksgiving table. I think that was my soundbite on that. Groups to which we look for evaluation. What was the point of the discussion on dyads and triads? Somebody tell me. Talking about group size, what's the takeaway from that? As the group gets bigger, what else does it get? More stable, that's right. Dyads are the most unstable of small groups, and because we have a dyadic relationship on our society called family, what have we invented to stabilize that inherently unstable group of two? Yeah, we've invented marriage to do that. Because if one person leaves or dies, no more group. You know, at the moment, our group has gathered, and we've probably got at most a third of our entire gathering, and yet we press on. Go ahead.
So when you get married, like, vows and stuff that you take, are they just kind of formality, really, you're just signing a contract?
Are the vows a formality? No,
you
think...
You know what I'm saying? Like,
sure.
Because their marriage was made up to keep people together.
Sure.
But is it really more of just a contract that you're signing?
It's both. He's asking, what creates a marriage? That's an interesting question because I answer it every time I preside at one. You want me to go into all this? Okay. People sometimes say, well, when is the couple actually married? We want to get a picture of it from when they're... It's exactly the second that they're now married. And a lot of people think it's when the minister says, I now pronounce you. And they didn't do with what I say. I tell them that they're married as soon as they get done with their vows. They have made that promise. Now, that's the emotional contract. That's the social contract. When we pray about it, it's a religious contract. But we also got to sign the license and get it filed in the courthouse. And there's a legal component to that as well. And because it's also legal, and there are rights and responsibilities associated with that, that's what strengthens the dyad socially. Now, there's a big difference between emotional strength, and marriages are very strong that way. I don't mean to suggest that dyads are unstable emotionally. They typically are very strongly stable. But there's only two in the group, and that makes it, from a structural point of view, very unstable. You know, the group goes, even if it's a married couple and one child, if either of the married couple die, the other is, they have a new identity, widow or widower, but the family unit is still there because they got the kid, right? It doesn't destroy the group if you got more than two people. Okay. And I may have overcooked that. Hardly ever happens. All right, what else? Anything else on in-groups, out-groups, reference groups, dyads, and triads. These are, you know, it's sort of a, it's kind of a vocabulary list. Go ahead. An in-group is any number of people to whom which we feel attraction or to whom we are drawn. The cool kids, right? An out-group, those that repel us. The dweebs and the nerds, or whatever you want to call them, right? And that can be kind of subjective, or, you know, it can be more formalized. We're drawn to this campus group more than that one, you know, and so on. But it's sort of an idea we keep in our head, an in-group and out-group. So there aren't so many formal, there aren't a lot of formalities associated with that. Anything else on these definitions of groups? We spent a lot of time talking about conformity. Solomon Ash did that card thing, you know, a dozen people can't be wrong. And then Milgram helped, you know, the man who shocked the world. There's a YouTube video on Ash and there's a reading on Milgram. Are there any questions about what that's about? Conformity is an extraordinarily powerful group dynamic. Groups produce conformity. Otherwise, there's no group. I mean, why would you be a part of a group that has rules if you don't want to play by them? Even if the rules involve doing something heinous to other people, you know, conformity is still a problem. Somebody came up to me after class and said, well, would that be like the Stanford prison experiments? And I'm going, yes. Philip Zimbardo, one of America's most famous psychologists, had to stop the Stanford prison experiments because people were once given the opportunity to abuse other people, just went after it. And an interesting little side on this. Most of you probably aren't old enough to remember in the aftermath of the first couple of years of the war in Iraq, there was a prison in Baghdad called Abu Ghraib. And you can read this. And there was a rather shocking to a lot of people story about American military prison guards abusing Iraqi prisoners, doing things like making them stand on boxes and hoods and hooking up electrodes to them and putting dogs next to them and in many ways being unspeakably cruel. And somebody asked Zimbardo, what do you think of that? And Zimbardo said, I read the news article, I was just blown away. He said, not surprised me at all. I got, from the 70s, I've got filing cabinets full of pictures exactly like that. You give people license, some of them will take it, you know. So, I mean, Google this. The Stanford prison experiments are another example of how conformity can produce abuse and violence, even. So, but that was the soundbite. Okay. Anything else on before we get into bureaucracy? Excuse me. I know I took the lecture out of order here. All I talked about with Weber's work on bureaucracy is that these are the characteristics of bureaucracies. These are the things that make bureaucracies bureaucratic. We divide up the work, we put authority on a ladder, we write down the rules, and who you are doesn't matter as much as what you do. Impersonality is and security, they kind of go together. That you can't be hired, fired, given a merit, or given a punishment just because of who you are or who you aren't. Let's say with respect to being related to the boss, that kind of thing. Any questions on that?
Can you go over division of labor?
Sure. Division of labor is just a characteristic of how complex organizations do complex things. We have people like professors who work at Texas Tech who do the professing. We have people who program the computer system, who administer traffic and parking, who run the financial aid office. All these things make the complex organization function. Bureaucracies, again, are kind of a meso-level way of producing functionality. And it's sort of on this point that Weber nudges into the functionalist side of the room. Okay? Anything else about anything else? Yeah. Totally missed that. Oh, written rules and regulations. This is how bureaucracies Maintain order. I have to do all kinds of online tests from time to time, telling me what rules are with regard to equal employment opportunity, Title IX, and so on. And it's not that they don't believe I know them. It's that they can say if I break them, hey, we told you. It's in the rules, and this is what you broke. Okay, well, then I have to accept my punishment. We write stuff down so that it's at least available for everybody to understand. You know, and I think where this is relevant to you is that the syllabus really is a contract for every class that you're in, both giving you rights and creating obligations. Fair enough? Okay, I'm going to shut the recorder off, and if anybody has any individual questions or anything else they want to say, I'll hang around until I don't need to. Thanks.